Hi, and welcome to Fresh Voices, the podcast where we tell stories and learn new perspectives. I'm Julia Pinney, Voices Editor for the Georgetown Voice. Today I'm here with Sienna Brancato to talk about writing a sex column. Sienna, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Sienna. I'm also on The Voice, and yeah, I write a sex column.
And what's this column called?
It's called Femme Intimacy. It's kind of a mouthful to pronounce, but it's Femme Intimacy.
Okay, and what was the inspiration for starting to write it?
So I think, like, towards the end of spring semester last year, since being in college, as I was starting to have more experiences, all that kind of thing, I was just noticing more about sex because I was gaining these experiences. And after getting out of a relationship, like, I think there's a different dimension to being in a relationship because it's a continuous monogamy with one person. So you notice different dynamics that you don't notice when you're sleeping around. It took up more of a sense of urgency in my creative work at first. So in the poetry that I would write and just things that I would be thinking about, it was just really taking up a lot of space there. And then I started working for Make Muse, which is the website that Femme Intimacy is housed on. And I was contributing pieces to that. And I noticed too that theme, the theme of sex in all of its sort of forms, was coming out a lot in that writing. And my editor for Make Muse, she reached out to me. She was like, "Have you ever thought of making this a column?" You know? And I said, "No, I hadn't thought about that, but now I am." And it just kind of started from there. I was like, wow, this would be really cool to do. And it would also motivate me in a more continuous way, in a more regular way, to keep writing about these things, because I think it's something important that I'm still exploring. And that's, I'm talking a lot, but that's, like, really a big point of the column.
Good.
It's a big point of the column is that I'm not coming at this from some expert perspective. I think that's what makes it unique, is, like, I am the age demographic of most of the readers of Make Muse and most of the readers who I'm trying to reach. And I've got, like, in my opinion, an average amount of experience. And so I have enough material to go on, but I'm also not, like, I'm still figuring things out. So I think that I offer that kind of a perspective, which is important. And I wanted to hold myself accountable for continuing to learn.
Yeah. Do you feel like a goal of the column is to continue to explore yourself and really reflect on your experiences, or to help others do that?
Both. I think, yeah, going off of that, I am very much not a fully formed sexual human being. Like, there are a lot of places where I want to grow and I want to learn and all of that. And I think you're right. Like, as I keep thinking of more topics, I'm prompted to think more about myself, reflect on what I would like, reflect on what I have done, all of that kind of thing. And my goal is that if anyone reading it identifies with it, that they're also able to process through the same confusion that they might be having, or similar confusions for other reasons. I think it's definitely a bit of both in that.
And did you ever feel like when you started publishing your first few pieces, because I know you have like 6 or 7 column installments up at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah, about 6 or 7. And did you ever kind of feel like, whoa, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I want this to be on the internet. Am I ready to be this much of an open book, be this vulnerable?
Oh, 100%. I think, so that came when I was first asked. That was part of the decision, part of before I had decided to actually do it. I was like, ooh, you know, what would happen if I did this? But then the urge to do it and the belief in what I was doing overpowered that, where I was like, there's a reason why I feel so uncomfortable about this. And that's the shame that's imposed on women and imposed on people in America in general, people everywhere. But obviously I'm speaking from an American perspective.
Yeah.
This intense shame that constricts us from saying what we want to say, or being who we are fully, or admitting things that are strange, or whatever shameful thing you might be thinking about yourself, the world that we live in tells us not to say anything about it. And so I was like, if I let my own reservations do that to me, then I'm doing myself a disservice. And so I think then for a while when I had started it, I was just more confident in what it was. But then my mom found out about it because I hadn't told her. And it wasn't like I was hiding it. I just didn't know how she would take it, and I wanted to explain it fully to her. But she saw the first social media post about it without me having a chance to explain it to her first, because I actually didn't know that it was coming out the day that it was going to come out. And I was like, oh, okay, it's out. And I was happy. But then she reached out. She was like, I wish you would think about these things, like, you know, what you get yourself into, and like, what if someone Googles you and your career? And I was like, yeah, because I didn't give it any thought. You know, I just jumped in blind, like, of course. And I was also thinking about the career aspect, which is something I explore in the most recent piece that's on the site, is if someone looks me up and finds this and doesn't want to hire me because of it, then I don't want to work for them, you know? And I mean, that's not to say that I'm shouting about this everywhere. Like, I just applied for something where they asked for writing samples and I didn't include writing samples. So it's this ongoing thing where it's still this process of comfortability. I still don't share them with my family actively. Haven't talked to my mom about it since that time, and it's been months. And, you know, there is that sort of sense, but I am okay with that, and I'm working to better that comfortability in the future.
And I know that you actively will change your Facebook posts to
make it so certain people don't see the posts. Yeah, I just think it's easier that way because, I don't know, just because of the family, it's a complicated story, but I think that's something that I need to do to feel like I can keep doing this and be able to share things on my own terms with certain people. So yeah, that's just a decision that, again, going off this whole thing where it's a process, like I'm still learning, I'm not this fully formed, confident in all aspects human being, like I still have to take these measures to then progress and evolve, and yeah.
Yeah. I guess something that I often think about, and I'm curious what extent you've thought about it. Why do you think, as Americans, we have such a hard time talking about sex? Why is it such a private topic in a way that it isn't necessarily in other countries?
I don't know if it's distinctly American. I do know that other countries are much freer about it, but some other countries are much more constrained about it. And so I think because America combines a lot of cultures, like we have people from all over the world who live here, there is this sort of, everyone's coming from a different background when we talk about it, and some cultures really stigmatize sex a lot more than others. And I think, I'm not sure why exactly America in particular. I think a lot of times, like, media messages to sell products or to sell messages or to promote ideas make us feel certain ways that make it hard to think about these things. And so say you see an ad where it's like my bikini body or my like hairless underarms or whatever it may be.
Or you see these Carl's Jr. ads that,
yeah, like have these girls, these like sexy eating models. This hamburger. Exactly. Yeah. It's like you're simultaneously, I want that and I don't want that, because you might want the hairless underarms because you think, oh my God, this person won't find me attractive if I'm hairy. But you might also not want to be the sexualized model eating a hamburger on TV. And so there's really this middle ground that's very hard to fall into, because it's like either I'm attractive, quote unquote, whatever that means, and people find me sexy, or I make my own choices about my body and suddenly I'm not. And that ties into sex too, like personal choices with grooming or when you lose your virginity, how many sexual partners you have. Every choice is scrutinized and every choice is condemned. There is literally no perfect thing, because if you are the abstinent child who never has sex and is like, oh my God, a person, like, no, don't come near me, I can't possibly, my purity, whatever you've been taught to espouse, whether that's your religion or your culture or just your upbringing or your, you know, and I'm not saying that abstinence is wrong, but whether you make that choice or you make the choice, I'm going to be free with my body, I'm going to enjoy sex, I'm going to have as much sex as I want to have when I want to have it, both sides are condemned. And even if you fall in that middle ground as your own personal choice, then your individual choices are condemned as well. So say you fall into that middle ground, whatever that is, and one time you choose to have random sex, and then another time you choose to wait until you're in a relationship, and it's just every choice is dissected. And I think that makes it really hard for people to feel comfortable expressing themselves, because they feel like they have to fall into one or the other, as opposed to inhabiting that middle ground or being allowed to inhabit that middle ground.
And I feel like this is especially an issue for women.
Yeah.
College age women, I'm sure, especially, because there doesn't seem to be an avenue. I know. Well, I guess, what was your high school sex ed like?
We had one class in eighth grade. So well before I was sexually active. I don't know about everyone else in my grade, but the friends that I've talked to who I went to high school with were like, wow, that was early, you know? And so, but then it was just, they talked about, oh, here's a cucumber, like, let's put a condom on it. Don't get STIs, don't get pregnant, use condoms. Okay, that's it. And I think we had something in seventh grade about the guys and the girls were split up and the girls learned about their periods and the guys learned about I don't know what because I wasn't there. But then it was just never addressed again. Like, health was only required in eighth grade, which I think is so harmful, especially because it wasn't a comprehensive sex education. It was, they didn't advocate abstinence like I know a lot of schools do, but they also didn't teach us how to have sex. They didn't teach us about pleasure. They didn't teach us about anything beyond preventative measures to prevent STIs and prevent pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, so I had a similar situation. My middle school, I went to the same school, 7th through 12th grade. And 7th grade, everyone had 4th quarter sex ed. And everyone, all the 8th graders would kind of go up to at the lockers because the 7th and 8th graders shared a locker and be like, oh, towards the end of 3rd quarter, oh, do you know what 4th quarter is? Oh, you're gonna get a permission slip soon. You'll find out, because we had to send a permission slip form home for our parents to sign so they knew what was going on. And so, yeah, 4th quarter, 7th grade, it was all about learning genitalia and learning about contraception, learning about STIs. But it was a very young age to broach the conversation of consent, of pleasure. So I don't necessarily know if that was the age to do it. But also, I wish that it had been brought up later in high school. Now that I think about it, we did. So we had junior sex night and senior sex night, but they were optional. You didn't have to go to them. And actually, I don't think I remember junior sex night. I don't think I remember actually hearing about it or it even being an option. And senior sex night, the whole idea of just sitting with my sophomore year AP World History teacher and talking about sex was just made me way too squeamish, just full disclosure. So did not go to that. But I have friends who went and they said it was actually a really good experience and a very open conversation. But I guess on this subject of consent, on the subject of pleasure, I feel like there's a real gap in American sex education. I did a project last year about Dutch sexual education, and I think of the Netherlands and Holland as one of these examples of a country of a place that is very, very open in their
more
comprehensive sexual education, very open in their conversations about sex, for better or for worse. I think some people look at them and say, oh, really? That's how you would handle that from an American perspective. For instance, it's much more normal for parents to be very open with their kids about sex. Mm-hmm. And it's not most American families, when they talk about sex with their kids, it's okay, don't get pregnant.
Yeah.
And that's where the conversation stops. And often it's not under my roof. That's a big American thing. Yeah. Not under my roof. While Dutch parents are kind of the opposite. They say, under my roof, this is how you're going to do it safely. This is how you're going to enjoy it. And this is how we're going to talk about it. We're going to continue to talk about it. And yes, have it under my roof and have them stay for breakfast. We'll hang out in the morning.
Oh my God, I think that's so much healthier.
It is a healthier way, but I don't know, maybe it was the way that I was raised or,
yeah,
I don't know. I look at that and think, whoa, that is so, that is so open. It does make me uncomfortable. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think
that's just acknowledging the American, that, you know, Puritan in me or no. Whatever.
Yeah, no, I think acknowledging that discomfort is really essential, because I think a lot of people don't acknowledge it. They just sort of have that knee jerk, ooh, and they don't really want to examine their discomfort and where it comes from. And honestly, I think the question of openness or non-openness with regards to sex really comes down to the question, like, what's so wrong about sex? Because the idea is like, don't have it, don't have it, don't have it. And yeah, I think you shouldn't have it until you're ready mentally and physically and emotionally to have it. You know, it's not saying, wow, when you're 5 years old, like, yeah, I'm saying when you are, as you decide, mature enough and ready to have it, I think you should feel comfortable doing that. I think the concept of you can't confuses me, or I understand where it comes from, but it confuses me because it's like if someone has the education to do it safely, like they understand consent, they understand protection, they have that relationship with their parents to confide in them, which not everyone has for a variety of reasons, and personally I didn't always have. But if they have that, then what's wrong about having safe sex? Like, if you're concerned about my child will get pregnant, teach them how to use protection. If you're concerned about my child will get an STI, teach them how to use protection. If you're concerned about my child will be assaulted, teach consent. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't, it's obviously not simple. And there's a lot of cultural factors that go into this, whatever your culture is. But I think ultimately what leads to a long-standing healthy relationship with sex is that openness. I think a lot of times this discomfort, this like knee jerk, ooh, that makes me uncomfortable, that scares me, that makes me nervous, whatever it is, leads to a lot of confusion later when you start having sex. And so if you're raised on this idea, sex is something we don't talk about, sex is uncomfortable to discuss, sex is something I shouldn't talk about with my parents, and then you get to the age where you want to have sex and you're like, I don't know what my body does, like, I don't mm-hmm. know how everything works, I don't know what I like sexually, so I'm not able to communicate that to a partner, and my sexual experience, particularly for women, is not as enjoyable as it could be if I was more knowledgeable about my own body. And I definitely don't blame people for this confusion. It's just something that I think can change and should change so that we can have healthier relationships with our bodies and healthier relationships with sex throughout our lifetime.
I think something that the Netherlands does do very well is they start, using air quotes here, they start sex education in preschool, which sounds crazy from an American perspective. But they're not talking about the specifics of intercourse to a four-year-old. They're talking about, do you like when Johnny hugs you, or do you not like that? Can you tell him, I don't like it when you hug me? Mm. What's the name of this body part? What's the name of that body part? How do I feel about my body? And do I feel that I have enough power to decide what I like and don't like? And starting those conversations so early makes it so when you get to an age where you actually have to talk about it, when you're 16, 17, 18, with a partner, then you're comfortable with it and you know
exactly.
You know what to do. And I think that's what scares me. I've talked to people who have been in situations where they don't have anyone to talk to because they haven't been raised in a society, in a neighborhood, in a world where they have someone that they can turn to talk to about sex, whether it's a teacher or an aunt or a mom or a friend, a sister. I think that's what scares me. I think it's a conversation that needs to be had, because that's when people get in trouble, when they don't know what to do and they don't know how they're feeling about something and don't realize that it's okay not to know how you're feeling about something as long as you can talk about it.
Exactly. And I think a lot of times people confuse, or intentionally confuse, educating kids about sex with advocating sex. And I mean, personally, in my own belief, I don't think that sex should be discouraged. But I also think, like, just telling students as they're growing up this information is not equivalent to saying, so you all should have it now, and you all should have tons of it. Like, I think it should be emphasized that it's a personal decision and everything like that. But that's, I think, a lot of Americans' sort of knee-jerk reaction is, oh my God, if I teach them about it, they're going to know, and then they're going to start doing it. And it's like, yeah, but would you rather that they don't know, and then they have this sort of stunted, uncomfortable relationship with it? Like, which do you prefer, you know?
I think what's really interesting is when you look at studies of abstinence-only sexual education programs versus programs that are have more of an emphasis on open communication and consent and pleasure. And really only, right now, only 24 states and D.C. have mandated sexual education, which I didn't realize. So that is crazy to me. And often it's dependent school district by school district. But when you look at these studies, it doesn't matter whether the program is telling you don't have sex or they're saying, okay, here's the information. We're not necessarily going to tell you one way or another. Kids more or less, or teenagers are more or less starting to have sex at the same age. The issue is that teenagers are not given the tools to talk about it, and the tools to protect themselves are getting pregnant more often.
And then certain religions advocate against abortion, or certain moral beliefs advocate against abortion. And so someone's in a position that where maybe if they had more sexual education, they wouldn't have been in that position.
Yeah.
That gets thorny, but
That gets thorny. So I guess shifting a little more personal, who do you talk to about sex today?
Ooh, mostly friends, definitely not parents, not for any particular awful reason. I just never had that relationship with them. Mostly friends. And also through the column and through my writing, that's how I parse through my feelings about it. If I'm having sort of an internal conflict about an experience, then a lot of times I turn to writing and I turn to research and I turn to how to convey that to someone else, because I think that makes me feel more empowered about it. Yeah.
And I guess the question that has been floating through my mind, mm-hmm. and I was curious about your opinion about it, was just, do you have a definition for virginity?
Oh, I think the definition for virginity is so wide-ranging, because I think our traditional definition of virginity involves heterosexual sex, penis in vagina, but obviously that's not the only way to have sex. And so for queer people, like, losing your virginity, quote unquote, can mean so many different things. And so I hesitate. I mean, I know how I define when I lost my virginity, but I do think that it's a personal choice. I also think the concept of, like, losing something in your first sexual experience is kind of strange, because I would say that I gained something. Like, yeah, I was no longer someone who had not had sex, but I didn't lose some precious, valuable thing. I didn't give away some part of myself. Like, I just had sex with someone, you know, and now I am a person who has had sex. And I gained a knowledge of what sex feels like, and I gained a connection with someone. And yeah, I just think that virginity is not a transaction. You don't give it, you don't take someone's virginity. It's not a thing that you can hold. It's not, I mean, I know that societally we have these connotations of what that means, but when you get down to it, it's just the first time you've had sex with someone.
Yeah. I think it's a good exercise to actively question the language we use around all of these topics.
Oh, language around sex is so violent, which I think really leads to the normalization of sexual violence. Mm-hmm. Like, and also, I nailed her, let's bang, let's fuck, like, oh God, it's all so aggressive, and it's so heteronormative and painful, especially mm-hmm. to hear as the woman in the scenario where you're like, why are you using this language of violence when you refer, and then the concept, like, make love is viewed as cheesy or, you know, too sappy, and guys are hesitant to say that because they think it makes them sound feminine, because of course being feminine is terrible and women are the worst, and why would anyone ever want to be a woman? You know, it's just this whole spiral of, like, the terms that we use around sex really shape our perceptions and influences the way that we think about it.
I was having a conversation and someone brought up to me the idea that virginity being defined as intercourse really takes away the idea of female pleasure, because most women...
I'm snapping if you can't hear.
Most women, when they think about the first time they had intercourse, that was a painful experience. That was not a pleasurable experience. And so someone brought up to me the idea of, what if virginity was actually the first time you orgasmed with someone else? And I heard that and was like, whoa, that's
kind of... We'd all be losing our virginity a lot later.
a whole lot later. And that's kind of radical. And that's...
Yeah.
That's kind of freaking wonderful, actually, that definition.
No, I really like that, because I think you're right to touch on this, where a lot of people are scared to have sex, or a lot of women are scared to have sex because they think that it's going to be painful. And sometimes it is, but it shouldn't be. It's a lack of the things that, like, a lack of foreplay, a lack of proper concern for how your partner is feeling. And obviously, in the first time you have sex, you're not going to be, like, fully realized, I like this, 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 and this. Mm-hmm. That's something you gain over time, and you gain with self-knowledge, and you gain with masturbation and being in touch with your own body. But I think the concept of the orgasm gap, so that men orgasm way more frequently than women, and there's a huge gap, and women don't ask or don't prioritize themselves, and or told not to prioritize themselves.
Women often fake it.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting definition for a loss of virginity, because wow, yeah, a lot of people who I know, and me personally, would have lost their virginities a lot later.
And I guess another question that I was curious your opinion on is, and work with me for a second, mm-hmm. Do you feel that sex in itself is an intimate act?
I think it can be. I think it doesn't have to be. I also think there's different types of intimacy. So there's, like, emotional intimacy, intellectual intimacy when you're having a really good conversation with someone. There's sexual intimacy, of course. And I think, like, it's inherently intimate if you are having penetrative sex. You are, as a woman, like, I'm literally letting someone into my body, mm-hmm. physically. And so there's no way for that not to be intimate for me. But I also think that, like, sex can be very impersonal. Or not impersonal, because obviously your partner should, whoever that is, whether you're in a relationship or not, should be in tune with your body and in tune with your cues, what you're telling them, your pleasure, and it's reciprocal and all of that. But I don't think that all sex has to have this emotional attachment to it. Or I think the perception is that, like, girls get attached after sex, or, ooh, I've got to, you know, cut that off before she gets way too attached. And that, I feel like, in my experience and the experiences of my friends and people who I know, that is definitely not the case. I think women are equally capable of having casual sex that as men are, and everyone in between. I think everyone can have casual sex. Whether everyone wants to have casual sex, that's their personal choice.
Yeah, it's a personal, yeah, but it's a personal choice.
I don't think that sex has to be intimate emotionally, even if it is intimate sexually, because you are allowing someone to touch you and come in contact with you in a number of ways.
Because I do feel like that is an important distinction that I often feel like is not talked about a lot.
Yeah.
And also, in a way, it stigmatizes those who haven't had sex, because it's suddenly this idea that you haven't had
this intimate connection.
This intimate,
like,
connection with
you
someone.
You don't know. It's, well, what?
When, in fact, in my opinion, some of the most intimate moments I've had have nothing to do with being naked with someone else.
Yeah. Or some of the most intimate moments I've had have been being naked with someone else and not having penetrative sex, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of that moment when, you're kind of done with whatever you're doing, and you have to reckon, you have to stare the other person in the eyes and reconcile,
oh, yeah,
kind of what you've just done and what you've let each other do, and how that might be kind of awkward, and how you're not sure how you're feeling about it all, and kind of have to decide, okay, well, are you leaving now? Are you staying?
Yeah.
Often I feel like sleeping with someone in the same bed.
With someone is so intimate.
Is so much more intimate than any actual sexual act. Having to kind of negotiate.
You're losing consciousness next to another human being. Like, you are,
yeah,
literally, you're going to sleep. You are surrendering all pretense, all, like, defenses you may have put up, all performative aspects you may have used during sex, all, like, not autonomy, but all of your own conscious decisions about the way that you behave. You're, mm-hmm, you're passing out. You're going to sleep. You're not passing out. You're going to sleep.
You're going to sleep.
So,
yes,
yeah, it's incredibly intimate. And, like, my whole fear is, like, oh my God, what if they wake up before I do and they're just staring at me, and then they're confused because they don't know if they should get up, and I'm next to them, and I'm like, usually I wake up first, but yeah.
Yeah, usually
it's not a great night.
Honestly, to be honest, usually I like clockwork, have to pee at like 7 a.m. So usually I'm up before anyone else is, but that's way too personal. Although sometimes it is. I drink a lot of water, so there you go.
Sometimes it is a positive sign when you can have a good night of sleep next to someone who you're not, you know, dating, or you're not, whatever. That's a separate conversation.
That's a separate conversation. Well, thank you so much for being here, Sienna.
Of course.
This was honestly a fantastic conversation. So did my conversation with Sienna today make you think about a story you've always wanted to tell? Is there an opinion you hold that you've always wanted to talk about? Send an email to voices@georgetownvoice.com. I promise you will get a reply. Thank you so much, Sienna. Thank you again. Any last words for our listeners?
Let's all get a little more femme intimate with ourselves. That was so cheesy. I just really like the puns. No, seriously, if there's any takeaway, it's like, learn about your bodies, masturbate if you have not already, advocate for yourselves. Yeah, advocate for yourselves.
Great. Thanks, Sienna. Before I sign off, I'd like to thank Pana, this semester's assistant podcast editor, for our fantastic music, and give her, along with Kayla, our podcast editor, shout out. I hope you'll tune in next week for our next installment of Fresh Voices. Thanks for listening.